at college, one day, one person had a birthday party, and then within a month, the office of the president of the university was using it because it just was such a viral product and it was so innovative. At the time, the idea of it was so weird. And that just momentum becomes like plutonium for an entrepreneur, a hungry entrepreneur. And that then, you know, investors like kind of can pick up on that.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. James and Alexa Hirschfeld are brother and sister. They're also the co-founders of Paperless Posts, a huge part of helping to digitize the invitation experience, especially for all of us who never thought we'd ever go away from those hard copy invitations we would send for all types of parties and functions. At the time, James was in college and he had this idea and he took it to Alexa about creating a solution for invites to events and parties, but all through email. They became the co-founders of Paperless Posts, a premium invitation and event management platform. The sibling duo founded the company in 2009, looking to reimagine the experience of sending and receiving invitations. Well, they did. They now have over 175 million users. The company has sent out over a half a billion invitations and have partnered with designers like Oscar de la Renta to create custom invites. I love the fact that this was a brother and sister, and they love working together. I also knew they had grown up only a few blocks from where I currently live, so I certainly was excited to start out by asking them for my audience where they came from.
We were born on the east side. We grew up on the west side of Manhattan. Family, Jewish dad, and a Greek American mom who her own family was kind of entrepreneurial. They had a chain of diners in New York City. So had a lot of family in New York City, grandparents, cousins, and we were raised in Manhattan in the 90s was when we kind of were, you know, we were born in the mid 80s. And in the 90s, we lived in an apartment. It wasn't that big. We didn't have like a garden or a lot of space around outside, but we did get a computer, like an Apple LC2, probably in like the, you know, 1991 or something like that, with word processing and a game called Captain Goodnight on it. And we, you know, spent a lot of time on the computer. And then, you know, after things got a little bit more interesting with the internet on AOL and its messenger. So grew up in the city around computers and yeah.
How'd you like growing up just in New York City? And especially at that time, when you look back and, you know, early 90s, mid 90s, it's kind of when the city started to change a little bit in terms of crime and getting better as opposed to back in the 80s. And, you know, what was that like for both of you just kind of growing up during that time period?
I think it was pretty magical, but, you know, nobody has perspective on what they didn't experience. So we don't know what it would have been like to have a backyard or something like that. But I remember when I was first allowed to, you said your daughter is in ninth grade. I remember when I was about in ninth grade and I was first allowed to be outside by myself at night, it was it's one of the most amazing memories I have. Like I can just be out here with all these lights and I can potentially go wherever I want, as long as I come home by 11 p.m. So I think, yeah, it's pretty magical.
I think something about raising kids in a city that I've noticed as I have grown up and become like someone who lives in the same city, standing on my own two feet independently without any chaperones, is that when you have young kids in the big city, you have to kind of carve off a piece of it and make a little village, because I think you can't experience everything when you're 10 or 12. It's just like an overwhelming amount of stimulation. So we kind of had our little corner of the city where we lived, and we would go to different areas for whatever after school lessons or sports games, stuff like that. But really my world was just, you know, a pretty small radius between home and school. And when I turned 18, I remember seeing Washington Monument down in Washington Square Park for the first time. And I was like, what is this? This, I think I've reached the bottom of Manhattan. I didn't realize that it kept on going on and on and on.
Yeah. It's amazing to think that, and just talking about New York City and Alexa, it's funny because your dream of being out there in ninth grade and roaming the city and the excitement is my exact nightmare right now. So, but fortunately,
my parents too.
Yes.
Fortunately, that's what made it so fun.
Fortunately, one day you will be a parent and you will see there's payback, but at least now they have this app 360 where you can kind of track them. But it's really interesting talking about growing up and coming from a family, Greek, Jewish. There was, it sounded like a really close knit family. And what was your relationship like when you were kids?
I would say that we were, in the beginning, of course, we fought. But by the time we were 12 and 14, we were aligned and we had everything in common. And we were studying the same things, sharing things we were reading in school, or this beautiful poem or this passage from the Aeneid. Or James is always a good artist, so I would look at photographs or paintings that he would make. And I think, we became very close. And a lot of that closeness, I mean, to be honest, it was forged. The sort of beginning of the closeness was that we had our, you know, parents as a common, not enemy, but definitely a source of humor.
Yeah, I think that we, in the beginning, we were kind of not as close. And then when we became teenagers, we became closer. And I think by the time we were in college, I think we realized that we had a lot of respect for each other, but different ways of seeing the world and different strengths. And actually, as a result of that, we were talking in our early 20s about doing something together, whether that was some sort of creative partnership around like making movies, or where Alexa would be a producer and I would be like a writer or a director or something more business oriented. And so that was always kind of in the air, and then kind of attached an idea to that. We started with a desire to work together and then found an idea.
You know, it's interesting just in terms of, if you look at it, it sounds like you always knew you wanted to work together, but at the same time, it wasn't as if you wanted to be entrepreneurs or you wanted to start a business. How did that come about, and what made you want to actually be entrepreneurs?
I think that probably came from the time and the fact that James did have a good idea with paperless posts. I went to Harvard undergrad and James did as well. And I am the same. 2006 is the year I graduated. So there was a lot of optimism at that time about Web 2.0 and the internet. So we had grown up with, you know, AIM and CD-ROM games, and were definitely very comfortable native with computers and the internet. And we also remembered a time before. But then, I think, you know, basically Mark Zuckerberg was in my class, and there were a lot of other people that had gone to work at Facebook or started other companies. And so it didn't feel like, it was out of reach for us. And James had this idea and we didn't have anything to lose. So it was right around the time that I was just graduated and James was still in college. We had nothing to lose. So we had this idea. So why not try to put all of our time into making it a reality and see how far it gets us? Because there was just no opportunity cost.
And James, Harvard also, go ahead.
Well, Harvard does a great job of also teaching you, or they used to, that, you know, if you don't become like an investment banker or a consultant directly out of college, that you're going to starve. And so they have this subtle way of kind of pushing people into business. And so I think Alexa and I realized that we, after a couple of interviews, that we weren't going to be legendary management consultants or investment bankers, but we did have some creativity and some scrappiness. And so yeah, I think, you know, there was a lot of entrepreneurship around us. I was in a fraternity in college that was just full of people who were starting things. A lot of them have gone on to be really, really quite successful VCs and entrepreneurs. And so just around me, everyone had their laptop out and they were working on something. And when you see that happening and you're, you know, 19, 20, 21, and you have no bills, you know, you don't have a family or a mortgage or anything, and you can kind of survive for a bit without having like a big take-home salary, entrepreneurship is a great, great solution.
But I think it's important to mention this too. We did need jobs. We weren't like, we needed to pay for our lives. And we as James said, we weren't going to be working in investment banking or consulting. So this was a solution also to see if we could support ourselves doing something that we thought was interesting.
How did the idea come about?
Yeah, so I had the idea when I was about 21. And I think, you know, it's a time of life when you're in college where it's a very socially active time of life. You go to a lot of parties. I mean, I think in hindsight, I think I probably had like 5 hours of class a week. So you need to go to a lot of parties, you throw parties. And I was thinking a lot about how that whole process worked. And I had a big birthday party for myself when I turned 21 that I put a lot of thought and effort into planning. I wanted it to be a really special experience for all of my friends. And when it came time to kind of sending the invitation, there wasn't an option out there that allowed, I knew I wanted to send something digital because I didn't have the budget for paper and I didn't have my friends' mailing addresses, but I also wanted something that was personal and felt special and that was private and that kind of had the impact of something that was nicer and that showed how much care got into the party. So that was where the idea for Paperless Post came from. I realized that there was this big paper industry that was probably sort of on the decline as all this communication we'd witness in our lifetime move from paper to the internet and to messaging platforms. And there was still all this money being spent on paper stationery, which is, you know, not very efficient, not very good for the environment, and unbelievably expensive and out of reach for most consumers. And so I thought, you know, what if we could create a platform that has the specialness of that type of product, but combined with the, you know, efficiency and immediacy and cost effectiveness of digital communication and kind of elevate digital communication more, because all emails look identical. And, you know, the options out there in terms of digital invites were pretty limited. So that was where the idea came from. It sort of started with a vision. I called my sister and I pitched her the idea. And she was like, you know, I don't know, how would we make money? And I said, I really think that people would pay for a product like this. I think if we build a product that's good enough, if people are paying, you know, hundreds of dollars for wedding invitations, maybe we can just get a small amount of money, $10, $15 for in exchange for a higher quality user experience and in exchange for a better looking product and data privacy and all of these things that you don't get with the other options out there. And it was a moment of being kind of like knowing so little that it was powerful, because all of the powers that be and all of the really kind of thought leaders in tech at the time, we're seeing what was happening with, you know, Twitter and Facebook taking off. And, you know, the future was about democratizing information and communication and everything being free and everything being ad supported and being big data play. And the idea that consumers would pay for a service, a digital service, was just really, really, really dwindling and not a very popular idea at the time. And so a lot of people laughed at us, and we just sort of were like, well, I think it's going to work. It's logical. And so that was how we pursued it.
Alexa, what sold you? You know, it sounded like you had a little bit of a hesitation when James came to you, but what was it where you finally said, you know what, let's do this?
It was the way that he was describing the product. It was very visual. It was very obviously about the differentiation was going to be the design. And I had these memories of showing people James's, like I said earlier, you know, looking at myself, but also showing my friends his paintings or his photographs or his like dabbling in sculpture. And I remember their reactions was always so positive and admiring. And I was impressed by it too. And I just remember he has a good sense of design and a good sense of what looks good, to put it simply. And so I thought to myself, if a big part of this is what it looks like, which I do think is important, then I imagine if we could figure out how to leverage, you know, the internet and the ability to make immersive experiences like in the browser as well, and we could let someone create something they're proud of, I do think that would be powerful. And I was just envisioning that a lot more people would have a positive reaction to James's design vision. So it was a lot me believing in him and his skills, and believing that if you leverage that over lots of people, that it could be a big, widely used product.
And I think that's a really powerful thing about working with a sibling. It's like what we were saying earlier, that you have siblings and you can't imagine working with any of them. And we have a third sibling and we really love him, but we don't work with him and he doesn't want to work with us. I think if you can work with your sibling and you know, you kind of know just a priori what they're good at, when to trust them, when not to trust them, and you have this kind of really, really settled understanding of how, of what you're getting. And I think that I also knew that Alexa was going to bring a lot of know-how to the table in terms of thinking about how to build a team and how to inspire a team and figure out how to hire engineers and hire product people and kind of like help raise money and just kind of knowing and trusting that the other person is good at what you know that they're good at is something that you get with a sibling that you don't get with a, or you get with a friend that you know really well that you want to start something with, but you don't get with a hire that you're just getting to know for the first time.
Yeah, it's great that you had that relationship. In terms of the third sibling, is the sibling younger, older, and how come you couldn't envision, or your sibling couldn't envision working with both of you?
I think we probably could. He's younger. He's like 6 years younger than me and 4 years younger than James. So we just haven't had the opportunity yet. But yeah, it just part of James and my working relationship is that we're so complementary and we're pretty different from each other. So it's really not just about a friend. It's not just about a friendship. It's like it's about bringing different things to the table, which is not actually, you know, only a result of being siblings.
Yeah. I want to ask you first, I have the most respect. We've had tons of entrepreneurs on this show from all different walks of life, levels. And I have the most admiration for, we've had a lot of restaurateurs, chefs. I think that is the one of the, if not the hardest business to be in. Tell me about growing up, and you must have seen that firsthand just from your mother's side of the family, and especially in the business of diners. And what did that help with?
So my mother's family on both sides comes from an island in the east of Greece called Chios, which is 12 miles off the coast of Turkey. And her great grandfather was a butcher, and her grandfather moved to the US with a background. All he really knew about, food is a common language. He didn't speak English. All he knew about was, like, you know, how to quarter a lamb and a cow. And I think he came to America and you know, the people that welcomed him, distant cousins or people that were cousins of cousins from the island that he came from, were all in the food business as well. And it was a time when there was a lot of innovation happening with food. The idea of eating out, feeding this workforce of people that were working in the city, in Midtown, people working in shops, people working, women working as secretaries at the time, you know, the idea of women going to work, and this big group of people that needed to be fed in a fast and efficient and kind of casual, inexpensive way was its own kind of big opportunity. And obviously McDonald's and all these companies around America were cropping up and figuring out how to capitalize on that. And I think my great grandparents on both sides kind of got into the diner business and everything that as you said, it's incredibly challenging, you know, understanding real estate, understanding, you know, you have to be in the exact right location, understanding how to deal with, you know, the pushcart people that are coming and selling hot dogs outside your front door, and who are backed by the mafia, and understanding how to make sure that you're delivering a high quality product at a low price that's got product market fit in the right location. I mean, I never really worked in an Alexa, and I did stints as waiters, and she, Alexa, was a hostess. I was a waiter. But yeah, I think that it taught my mom, who was a lawyer and never went into the business, but just seeing her parents work in the industry, such scrappiness and such a sense, such a toolkit of problem solving, and kind of like a down to earthness about dealing with people from all walks of life, whether you're selling a hamburger to Jackie Kennedy or you're dealing with someone who just arrived in the country who is critical for running your business in some way. I think my mom had a sense of possibility about creating a business in this country. And even it was interesting, even when, you know, recently during COVID, when our business was really under a lot of pressure because of this incredible exogenous factor that basically was like a torpedo to our entire business and model, you know, business model of business. It was interesting to see my mom, because our mother, you know, works with us and is invested in the company in a lot of different ways. But to hear her talking about getting PPP and how her father used to get government loans and just kind of like going back to that scrappy, just really basic business know-how that I think when you've raised a lot of venture capital and you've been kind of cocooned in this industry that's been growing and that is so well funded in this like kind of wonderful time that we've been able to grow our business in, you don't always have that kind of pressure that I think my great grandparents and grandparents had, just building a company from nothing with no capital, no VC backing, just with sweat and with bank loans. It was very interesting to see that muscle memory come back.
More from our guest. But first, a word from our sponsors. This episode of How Success Happens is being presented by State Farm. Being a small business owner can be so fulfilling, rewarding, and let's be honest, a little scary from time to time. Doing your own thing and being your own boss is great, but sometimes it can make you feel like you're all alone, especially when things aren't going great. Well, the folks at State Farm want you to know you're not alone. State Farm has thousands of agents who are small business owners too, so they know what it takes to protect everything you've worked so hard for. State Farm has an assortment of insurance policies for small businesses that can be tailored to your needs. So whether you're a hairstylist, an electrician, or a florist, State Farm agents are ready to help. Learn more and find an agent today at statefarm.com/small business. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And our next sponsor. Are you constantly finding yourself with 50 tabs open a day, hopping between tools just to do your job? Notion is the most customizable tool that helps teams organize information, manage projects, and get more work done together, all in one place. More than 70% of teams that use Notion stop using two or more tools because they didn't need them anymore. For companies of all sizes, Notion provides one central and customizable workspace that can be tailored to fit any team and brings all teams together to get more done and move faster. Notion is an all-in-one team collaboration tool that combines note-taking, document sharing, wikis, project management, and much more into one space that's simple, powerful, and beautifully designed. With powerful integrations, an API, and seamless navigation, you'll have everything you need in one spot so you can make speed your advantage without the silos and context switching that slows companies down. Plus, Notion has a worldwide network of millions of users, creating templates, tutorials, and new inspiration. The product is getting better all the time, and you'll always have the support you need. Learn more and get started for free right now at Notion.com. Take the first step toward an organized, happy team today. Go to Notion.com to get started today. And we're back. Do you think you both got your grit? Because I know every entrepreneur gets thrown to the mat. And I want to talk about COVID, because obviously that was, I am sure, one of the biggest challenges you've faced in your years. But do you think you learned or really understood what it took
from seeing the grit of your relatives running these diners? Because I eat at a lot of diners and you just see how hard these folks are working, how hard it is to survive, especially in New York, when you look at how much it costs to lease space and now how much it costs to pay employees.
The delivery companies and, you know, with Grubhub and taking your margin. And
do you think you learned your grit from that?
I think I would say, what I would say is my mom has a lot of grief for a reason, which is that she thinks she never wants to be in the food business. It's like the hardest way to make money. I think maybe what we got from that background is an entrepreneurial spirit and the belief that in the US you have the ability to succeed if you are hungry enough and you work hard. And I think that, I mean, yeah, we can go back really far, but I think also Greek people in general, wherever they immigrate to, are often, you know, it's a diaspora culture. People left for various reasons over the last few hundred years, and they do tend to start businesses. And so I think like the food business is just like a way to enter, the way to make it when you get to a new country. But I think, and by the way, that island they're from is like, the wars were always very bad there because it was so near Turkey. So a lot of the people that left Chios left in like the context of war or famine. And so a lot of the Greek ship owners are Chiotis, or a lot of Chiotis have been like they've been outside of Greece for a long time. And yeah, in our family, it was just, that's the business that they went into. But I think maybe it's one, the scrappiness comes from like one step before that, which is just coming to a new country, needing to support your family, finding something that you can do that is useful to people and doing that. And I think that that particular business was like not something that at least my mom and her brother wanted to stay in, even though her dad had tried to kind of innovate and did a good job in like fast, basically it was like diner, but it was more like trying to create fast food chains in the 50s around the time that was taking off. But I think we're definitely super happy not to be in the food business.
Yeah,
and would probably never go into it.
Software is a little better than like hamburgers, but I think the scrappiness, yeah, I definitely think it comes straight down through, you know, through my mom from her parents and her grandparents.
So talk about starting Paperless Post. You get together, you begin the business. James, you're still in college at the time.
Yeah.
What was that like? And take me through just the initial stages, early challenges, and then when you finally realized, hey, maybe we have something here.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there was a really, really, really massive learning curve because my sister and I both studied humanities. So while we had a lot of confidence in the idea and we had a lot of confidence kind of in our innate abilities, we didn't really know anything about building a business plan or about creating software or code or even how to do web design, all of which was much more immediately what we needed at the time to get even a prototype off the ground or an alpha. So we spent a long time trying to figure out how to do that. And we really had to fake it till we made it and work with contractors, work with classmates who had a couple of months available between terms here and then, work with people for free, work with kind of piece to cobble together it wasn't an MVP. It was really a prototype that kind of worked. It had a few features, but something that basically allowed to kind of show the idea. And that took a lot of effort because anybody who was really good didn't really want to work for two people with our profile. Just because we were so young, we didn't have a lot of money. We didn't have a track record. I think when things really started to come together for us was when we had something that we could put in front of real users, like prospective users, and we could kind of, they could create something, they could send it, and we could gauge the interest in this type of product. And that was when that kind of gave us the confidence to go and raise money and try to build something that we could actually scale. So it was, and then after the first time we had real users sending the product and seeing how quickly it was spreading at college, one day, one person had a birthday party, and then within a month, you know, the office of the president of the university was using it because it just was such a viral product and it was so innovative at the time. The idea of it was so weird. And that just momentum becomes like plutonium for an entrepreneur, a hungry entrepreneur. And that then, you know, investors like kind of can pick up on that.
Were there any challenges early on? Was there ever a time that either you thought you couldn't work together or there was an outside challenge where you thought maybe this might not be the right business for us early on?
I would say that we were, and maybe this is why we made it and didn't scrap the project like so many startups, you know, do get scrapped. I would say we were almost pigheaded in our determination to succeed, and failure wasn't an option. So we just like, there were a lot of weird and upsetting like bumps in the road that we had to cross, you know, rejection from investors, rejection from people who wanted to hire, people that we had hired or, you know, brought on as partners, quitting at really bad moments, competitors coming up that at the time seemed like they were going to cream us because they were founded by people who had really big jobs at big companies and had a lot of experience. And we were just two like kids who didn't know really anything, but we just really, really were determined, like we were going to basically die before we failed. And that's dangerous. I mean, we're lucky that it worked because we could have really hit our heads against a wall for a long time, but we, no.
Where do you think that resiliency in both of you comes from?
I think part of it comes from being siblings that are founders because, you know, for us being like, if we're successful, it's double the joy because as partners, like caring about the other person and being like, not just as a, like someone that I'm doing a project with or someone that I have a working relationship with, but someone who's also a really close friend and family member gives you that extra like strength to push forward because you've got a lot invested in it emotionally. And I think that, I don't know.
I think also at the end of the day, I don't know whether, I think maybe it was a different, it was a different type of resilience before the product launched where that was like, well, we have nothing to lose and we have a goal and we want to make it happen. But then after the product launched, which by the way, was before we had really raised money, from that point on, we had this relationship with users. And I really think that was like a gun going off and it's like a race starting. It was a totally different experience since that time. And even in the depths of all the dark and depressing times that entrepreneurs all go through, we've always had users and they've always been, some of them have been like all companies, like really big fans and they get it. And we're really solving a problem for them. And we're doing, I think that users can tell that we're doing it in a way that's not pandering. We're like really trying to make their party successful and make them look good and give them the most original assets to create their own design that reflects their personality and give them tools to make it easy to organize with their guests and communicate. And I think, and they pay us too. So they're also our customers. So I think part of it comes from like, we want to continue to serve users with the best product and serve more people with a good product.
You know, in the time we have left, I want to ask you first, talk to me about COVID. And I mean, if you think of a business that was going to face a major challenge, you think of paperless post when there are no more events, right? Or right. Whatever might happen.
Right.
Take me through that time period and how you got through it.
Yeah. So it definitely caught us by surprise, like everybody. I think the impact to our business was really extremely negative for the reasons that you mentioned. I mean, basically on like March 12th, 2020, people shut down, people stopped going to work, people stopped organizing parties. And we realized that as social distancing became like a word, that it was, you know, our mission is to help people gather in the real world in a more meaningful way. And everything that we do that's core to what we do was running against what the world needed to do to deal with this public health crisis. And basically we were in the business of of spreading COVID. I mean, if people were having parties, they were, you know, spreading COVID at a time when that meant something different from what it does today. With really, really, really even more dire consequences. And so I think, again, in a way, kind of kicked back into a early startup gear of when the rug is pulled out from under you and then you really, things get really real. We had to do a bunch of, maneuvering to stay afloat, everything from, you know, obviously getting money from the government. I think we were one of the first companies to get a PPP check. To raising money from our equity investors, to renegotiating our debt, negotiating with our landlord, cutting our team in it, which was incredibly difficult. That is such a horrible time to have to let people go. And all of that while trying to retain the people who we needed to keep the business going and to make sure, retain the people and hold on to our growth capital to allow us to come out on the other side and be successful and thrive. And I think what we didn't change, I made a decision early on that I wasn't going to spend people's, our money and our precious employees' time chasing after passing trends or what I believe would be passing trends like virtual events, which at a time seemed like a great solution for a company like ours because people were trying to figure out how do we get together without getting together. We never, I didn't spend a lot of time on that. Didn't spend a lot of time trying to transform ourselves into a greeting card company because at the time also the greeting card side of our business was really skyrocketing because people were not able to see each other. So they were sending each other really nice notes. But rather than try to transform the company into something else, only then to undo it at the end of COVID, which I was, pretty confident was going to be, that it wasn't going to be a forever situation. We took the time to do this very painful platform unification, basically, where we had built a new platform that was growing a ton called Flyer. That was like really cool, mobile first, casual, free product that was driving a ton of growth for our business on the event in terms of events and engagement, but not a ton of revenue because it was a free product. And then we had our legacy platform, which was driving 95% of our revenue, but wasn't growing as much. And we knew that at some point we were going to have to bring these two platforms together. And it was going to be a really painful technical debt project. We were trying to push it off and push it off and push it off. And basically in April, like 2 weeks into COVID, I said with Alexa and our CTO and our chief product officer, like, this is such an obvious moment to do. This is going to be a year and a half or we're not going to grow no matter what we do. We might as well do this really difficult thing. And then hopefully if we get through it on the other side, we're going to have a platform that is much better designed for growth and for helping us, move into the next 5-10 years of the business. And that's what we did. And it really worked. Like, we've had a really, really unbelievable rebound, better than we could have hoped for. And a lot of it is because of that decision and the growth that we're seeing on this new platform. So that was, I feel really, really good about that. There were some horrible, horrible moments and kind of breaking apart or breaking down something that you've built so carefully and lovingly is traumatic, but I think that it was super positive in the end.
Yeah, I love that you did that. You didn't just go follow and try and do something quick, like get into greeting cards or virtual events. And I just think that right there must have been such a key element to your success. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know, post-COVID, I have noticed, I don't know if it was just going through it and people, and now we're in the stage where we're getting a lot of invitations and there's parties. And for whatever reason, I am seeing less invitations, like hardcover invitations, and much more paperless posts. It almost seems like it was a positive. Yeah. Why is
Yes, that? There, I think that, I mean, I don't want, Alexa can jump in too, but that was another dynamic that was really interesting to see during COVID. The business, we're in a lot of different categories, from kids' birthday to Christmas parties to weddings to professional events. And it was interesting to see kind of which ones were hit the worst and which ones grew. What one thing that we saw was that a lot of categories, particularly wedding and baby shower, where people would have been sending paper invitations, were sending digital invitations instead. And I think that, people said the pandemic accelerated a lot of things that were already happening, like certain types of e-commerce commerce activity that moved, that accelerated really quickly, or people like streaming really, really, really overtaking like movie theaters and the things that were already happening, but to kind of catalyze an acceleration. And I think for us, with the pandemic moving so quickly, people were trying to get married in these short periods of time when they real, when, you know, when the, you know, make hay while the sun shines, like we've got, we know that COVID is in a lull. We need to have this wedding now. And so people who would have been sending paper for their wedding invitations were moving online because it was a lot more nimble and you could message about it and you could collect data about who's vaccinated, who isn't vaccinated, all of that stuff that we had to do. And then what we've seen is that a lot of that behavior has not really subsided.
I think it's a little like remote work. It's like once you realize you can, people do more because it's hard to put the cat bat in the back in the bag. I don't know if that's a real saying, but
I think it's the genie back in the bottle. But I like
genie, that you can't put the genie. You can't. It's hard to put the genie or the tooth. Yeah. It's hard.
I like to put my dog back in the bag every night.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think that ultimately this was always a vision that we thought. We didn't know exactly the period of time, but as millennials, when we were trying to raise money in like 2008, 2009, and we were told by investors, okay, that type of communication behavior you're talking about will always be paper. It'll always be paper. And we were like, we really don't think it'll always be paper. We really don't. But we didn't know necessarily like how long it would take to have people feel comfortable bringing that behavior online. And I think that this COVID was a helpful catalyst in accelerating a shift that we do believe is what's going to happen.
Yeah, I have no doubt. And look, I want to thank you both for coming on How Success Happens and wish you the best of luck and the challenges you've gone through. It sounds like your mom really gave you guys some grit, and I would never bet against you both. And I hope I continue, and I'm sure I will, to see paperless posts continue to grow. So appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. It's really fun to talk.
So fun.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost. And I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business. Or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.